A pleasant afternoon to all of you. It's nice to see so many of you here. It's good to have people to rejoice with on a Sabbath day. There's something going on in our nation that some of you may know about. Good chance a good number of you won't know about it unless you're a sports fan. And that is, the World Series is underway. I doubt very many of you in this room are terribly worried about that. I'm not terribly worried about it either, but watching it just briefly the other night brought back a memory. And perhaps it's a memory that some of you young men, maybe some of us who years ago used to take up that ball and bat, used to play with, it's a memory that I want to share with you, because I know that a good number of us in this room will identify with it. I don't know exactly how you ladies will. I don't know, unless you ladies played softball or t-ball or baseball or bowling. There's probably some comparison, so you glean from it what you would like. Watching the World Series the other evening, it was getting late into the ninth inning, and the number of batters came up, and I recalled sitting there watching it. All of a sudden, I was getting involved in the sports, and I was rooting for the underdog. I wanted the underdog to make a showing and to come back and to win the game. I wanted something to happen. And when I watch sports, I do all sorts of things. I get to, you know, tense, and I'll push my leg out, or I'll jerk around like this. Because if you've ever played sports, that goes with that. But I remember sitting there thinking, all right, now he's coming up. It all rests on the shoulders of this one player. Wonder what he's going to do. Wonder if he's going to get a hit. Wonder if he's going to strike out. What's he going to do? And I knew that if he struck out, the game was over. So I watched closely, and all sorts of emotions and feelings were inside of me, because I remember way back when I was a little leaguer and played ball, that I've had a similar situation happen to me. Maybe you've had it happen to you. Let me set it up for you just a little bit, because I want you to get into this with me. Here it is, the bottom of the ninth. Two out. I don't care how many people are on. Let's just put one on. You come to bat with the ability to win the game. And you're a little bit unsure of your skills, but you're the man. You're the hitter. You get up there and you get ready, and the pressure's on. You stand up there and you look at that pitcher, and that pitcher looks down at you, and he takes that ball in his hand, and he throws it down there the best he can. He throws just a snappy little fastball, and you're quite anxious. Your heart is beating quickly, and so you swing at it and you miss, and you got strike one. So you shuffle around a little bit, kick the dirt. We've all done that. Now you know the number two pitch is coming. Now there's more pressure on you than before. You stand in there, and all of a sudden he throws you an inside slider for a ball. 1-1. Now there's a little hope, but you know you don't have two strikes on you. Now there's just a little bit of hope. You stand up there, and he throws you the prettiest curveball you've ever seen, and you don't even swing at it. Strike two. Now the pressure's on. You step back from the plate. I've done this. I don't know if any of you ever played ball. You take that ball bat, you tap those cleats. I don't know why we do that. It's just something we do. You just tap those cleats. Sometimes there's dirt on there, sometimes there isn't. It just feels good to bash your foot. You just hit that foot. That's part of the ritual. You step out of the plate, you tap your cleats, step back in, and here comes a knuckleball, ball two. Now you've got this thing figured out. You think you know what's going to come next. The pressure is really on you. You look at your hands, you grab that taped up handle, and your hands slide around just a little bit. Beads of perspiration are on your forehead, and your eyes just a little bit blurred, because you know it's coming right down to it now. So you stand in there, another blazing fastball comes just barely wide of the plate. Ball three. More pressure. Now it comes down to the final pitch, the last one. The pressure is far greater than it ever was so far, because it all rests on what you do next. You step up to the plate, and you look around, and you hear the cheers of all the people, because they're on their feet. They're rooting for you. They're cheering for you. They're really into the game. You take that deep breath, step out of the plate, though, and you take a little bit of dirt. You have to rub that dirt around in our hands. Maybe throw it on our pants, because we're a ball player. You get back into the batter's box, and there you are facing the pitcher, knowing that it's now or never. He winds up, he throws the prettiest change of pace that you ever laid your eyes on, and as you swing way ahead of the ball, the umpire says, strike three! You're out. Any of you ever had that happen? I've had that happen. And as I was in there, I remember thinking way back then, because I was introduced to the church quite early, I remember standing in there, and you know what I was hoping for when it came down to that last pitch? Oh, God, give me a miracle. Give me a miracle. Give me a hit. And there I struck out. Now, let me tell you something. Going to bat in the ninth inning is nothing compared to stepping into an intensive care unit when you've been called by a desperate family to pray the equivalent of a home run. And that happens all the time. You can get a phone call. Our ministers get a phone call. Family's in distress. There's a tremendous emergency. And they call you up to visit with them or where their sick loved one is. And they, for all intents and purposes, are asking you to pray a home run, a miracle. Now, I know it's different because one's just a game and the other one's life. But all sorts of things get down inside of us as to whether or not we think God is going to do something for us, if God will respond to us, if God will do something to grant us a miracle. I know on a few occasions when this has occurred to me, and I have been called into an intensive care unit, I have prayed privately for a hit. And then I pray officially for God to grant me a miracle, or to grant these people a miracle. I remember years ago in Salt Lake City, a young couple, I would say probably in their 20s, who had been married for a number of years. They had so desired a child. She was not able to get pregnant. And then one day she came to church and she had a tremendously happy announcement to make. She was going to have a little baby. Oh, they were so excited about it. And the whole church got swept up into the pregnancy with this young couple, a church of about 250 to 300 people. We knew them all so well. We'd been over to their homes, and they got out the wallpaper, and they did the little bedroom and did all the things. I think they knew it was going to be a little girl because of the ultrasound. And they were so excited about it. And I remember one day getting a phone call, and it wasn't an emergency. It was an emergency to come up and visit with them in the hospital because she had delivered very prematurely this little child. Now, something I want to tell you is, I was not prayed up. You know what I mean by that? Because there are times, even when we have our prayer lunches through the week, that I recognize that when all of us assemble together, and on behalf of all the people who have written to us, I'm hoping that some of the ministers in that room are a little more prayed up than I am. Now, there are some days I'm ready. But sometimes I hope, I hope some of the other ministers in here can make up for what I am deficient in today. Because maybe I'm distracted. Maybe I'm tired. Maybe something's happened to cause my faith to diminish. And so I sort of look to some of the other men there. And sometimes, of course, we look to our wives for that. We look to close friends of ours to shore us up. I know we have the responsibility for prayer. I know we have to be faithful. But sometimes, in all honesty with you, I'm not full. I want to be full. But I hope that God understands sometimes that I'm not. I remember talking to these people. I performed the role of a minister quite well, I thought. For all intents and purposes, I was a man who could carry his Bible and walk into an intensive care unit. And I was supposed to be filled up with prayer and faith, and I was supposed to be able to perform a miracle for those folks. I mean, they knew a lot about faith. They'd heard a lot of sermons. I'd preached them a lot of sermons about James and the prayer of the faith, the prayer of the elder that would save the faith, the sick, and how important the prayer of faith was. I remember walking in there, and I was not quite prepared for what I saw. Yes, this little child was in intensive care, and I tried to give support to the folks, to the mother who was standing there, and she'd not fully really recovered, but she wanted to be there for this anointing. And it really weighed heavily on me, because we're talking about a life of a little child. And I remember walking up there, and I was thinking privately, God, and I'll put it in the language I just used to you, I need a miracle. These people need a miracle. We need a home run here. Now, I've gone up to the plate a lot of times. And you know, you don't ever get, if you don't step up to the plate, you never get a chance to get that hit. So here I was stepping up to the plate one more time. I remember taking some oil. I really, I didn't quite know how to handle this. I took a little bit of oil like this. I took it on my hands. And yet I couldn't lay my hands on the little child, because the child was in kind of a little special box and container, a little incubator type thing. I took the oil and I had to put my hands through a pair of gloves. And I reached in there and I looked at this little child, which couldn't have been much longer than this. a little baby girl. And I'll tell you, I needed a home run. And I needed a hit. The little baby needed a miracle. And so did the mother and father. I reached in there, and I prayed the best prayer that I knew how to pray. Those little rubber hands of mine on that little body, gently touching the child. I was even painfully aware of she seemed so brittle. And I didn't really know if she was going to live or not, but I prayed faithfully that she would. After I got through with the prayer, of course, Mom and Dad and all of us were quite anxious. There was a lot of pressure, especially for them, not so much for me. I just wanted a miracle. When I walked away from them, I've used words like you've used, because it's not only the ministry that's called upon to pray occasionally. All of us are called upon to pray. You're called to pray for your own family, for members of your family, extended family, or neighbors down the street, you know, who have gone through some kind of a tragedy or adversity, and they are calling upon you to step up to that plate and to pray for a miracle. They need help. They need intervention. So we use phrases like this. We'll say goodbye. Now you maintain your faith. God will see you through this. Try not to worry. God's in control. Have you ever used expressions like that? I have. What's sad to me about this story that I tell to you is that it was only a few hours later that I got a reminder, a strong reminder, that I and we do not get what we always expect. This little child died. And I realized once again that I'd stepped up to the plate. I didn't connect. I struck out. That I personally did not perform a miracle. How do you go on when our faith-filled aspirations are not matched by the outcome? How do you go on? When in this case, and it was a massive cry for a miracle, when it goes unheeded. And following it, there's a huge disappointment, because it rumbled through the church very quickly that this little newborn, premature little girl had died. And oh, the grieving parents. I still remember trying to comfort them. I felt so inadequate. And maybe it's appropriate to feel inadequate on occasion. When you've gone on record imploring God to act in a certain way, and He chooses to respond in another way, what do you do? Let me ask you this. Have you ever been asked to pray for someone yourself? Now, I'm not talking about just the ministry here, but yourself. Have you ever been asked to pray for someone and you found it hard to do because you were just a little bit off balance and you didn't know exactly what God was going to do? Perhaps so. I want you to turn with me to the book of Acts. And I was reading through this the other day, and I'd like to share some of these verses with you as a sense of encouragement, because how do we go on when prayers are not being answered, as some would say? How do we go on? And by the way, is it just the responsibility of the ministry? Or whose responsibility is this? I found some encouragement in Acts chapter 12. There's a miracle here, a rather dramatic miracle. Now, about this time, Herod the king stretched forth his hands to vex certain of the church. This is in verse 1. And he had killed James, the brother of John, with a sword. And because he saw it, that it pleased the Jews, he proceeded further to take Peter also. And these were during the days of unleavened bread. And when he had apprehended him, he put him into prison and delivered him to four quaternions of soldiers to keep him, intending until after Passover to give him to the people. Peter, therefore, was kept in prison. And this is what I like about this. But prayer was made without ceasing of the church of God, or of the church unto God for him. The church was praying. I've got a hunch that Peter was praying. I don't doubt that for one moment. But what I like about this is that I see the church is a praying church. A group of people who believe that God is going to make a difference. Even if it takes time, even if you have to be patient, God will see us through it. And He will direct us. It's getting used to the answers that's the problem. Because, oh God, I need a miracle. Swish. Strike three. One thing encourages me about this, though. If I step up to the plate often enough, even though I've struck out 9 times before, but the 10th time I stand up in there and I get that hit, you think it's worth it? if the 10th time I get the hit? So I would fail that opportunity if I say, oh, it's been 8 times. I'm not going to do this anymore. I'm tired of doing this. I don't get an answer. It just doesn't come. But then the number 9 and the number 10th time, you get up there, and sure enough, there comes that change of pace this time. You see it, and you get that hit. I may put it in that language to you. Notice the church is praying here, not just the ministry. The church people are praying. And when Herod, in verse 6, would have brought him forth, the same night Peter was sleeping between 2 soldiers, bound with 2 chains, and the keepers before the door kept the prison. And behold, it says, the angel of the Lord came upon him, and a light shined in the prison. And he smote Peter on his side and raised him up, saying, get up quickly. And the chains fell off from his hands. Series of miracles here. And the angel said to him, gird yourself and bind on your sandals. And so he did. And he said to him, cast your garment about you and follow me. And he went out and followed him, and wist not that it was true, which was done by the angel, but rather thought that he had seen a vision. I think we can identify with that. When they were past the first and the second ward, they came into the iron gate that leads into the city, which opened to them of his own accord, and they went out, and they passed on through one street, and forthwith the angel departed from him. And there's Peter. Now what's he going to do? When Peter was come to himself, he said, now I know of a surety that the Lord has sent his angel, and has delivered me out of the hand of Herod, and from all the expectation of the people of the Jews. And when he had considered the thing, he came to the house of Mary, the mother of John, whose surname was Mark, where many were gathered together praying. I like that too. Many were gathered together praying. And so there are requests made to the ministry. There are also requests made to the people of the Church of God International and the people of God around this land. It's something we must all do together. Because you see, there may be those occasions when I don't need to be the one that stands up there and takes that hit. You do. You can reach God. I can't. Now, that doesn't mean I shirk my responsibilities. I want you to know that. Because I'm going to keep on doing it. Even if it's the 8th time, 9th time, 10th time. Because in all of this, I've learned a lot over the years about faith, about people turning to us for prayer. I've learned a lot about answered prayer. I've learned that God doesn't answer prayers the way I want Him to. But He's still there, and He's still listening. Have you ever cried out to God for direction in your life? Definitive direction. God, I don't know what to do. I want You to show me. Have you ever done something like that? I have. And oftentimes, something would come about, or occasionally, I should say, not oftentimes, something would come about which I would think, now that's curious. That's curious. Let me tell you about a true life drama and experience which made me think when I read about it. This happened in 1994 in February, so just not too long ago. This story involves a man whose name is Dale Chiminti, and he was from Troy, Michigan, as I recall. And he was on holiday, and he was on a vacation, and with him he took his family, and part of his family, of course, were his younger children, and he had a godson, as he called him, by his wife. I'm assuming there must have been some kind of a previous marriage or something, some special arrangement there. Now, his name is Dale. His godson's name was Danny, and he was 24 years of age. Here it is, Friday afternoon, and they're getting ready to relax. It's vacation time, and Danny comes up to Dale and says, listen, let's go jet skiing. Oh, last thing you want to do is do that, but just to be part of the fun, he said, okay, I'll do that. So they went down to the Bender on the beach. And there were jet skis there. I guess just a couple were there. And so they picked out two. One of them didn't look too well. Actually, both of them didn't look very well. One of them looked cracked and looked like they'd put together with fiberglass putty. But didn't look real strong. Aside from all that, they decided to rent these two jet skis. Well, in the course of the preparation for it, the vendor said, now listen, if you lose this or something breaks down and the machine is destroyed, it's going to cost you $5,000 each one, $5,000 apiece. He was a frugal man, so he remembered that detail. That detail, by the way, later on was really going to cause him a great deal of problems. Well, just before they got onto these worn machines, Dale said, well, look, there's a couple of life jackets. Let's put these things on. They didn't look very good, but they were at least buoyant enough to keep them up. So they put them on. Sure enough, they went out there and they were jet skiing around like all of us would do. But he noticed that his particular machine, this is Dale's machine, the father, it sputtered and it'd die out. It'd stall out. It'd start up again, stutter, and then finally it just died. And they were way out from shore. So he did what any one of us would do when Danny came next to him in the jet ski. He said, listen, help me with it. Can we get it into land? And he said, well, we don't have any rope. We can't do anything about that. So he said, okay, I'll tell you what. You leave me, go into shore, and get help. And he said, okay, I'll do that. And he remembered as he watched him go off in the jet ski that that was a poor piece of advice, because having been a former lifeguard, he remembered that one of the things you don't do when someone is in trouble is you don't leave your buddy. Remember that? You don't do that. When you're in trouble, your friends need to be there with you. You don't need to be left alone. You need to have somebody there with you. Nonetheless, he watched him go off, and he was there thinking it would be just a matter of time before he would be picked up. Unbeknown to him, as he was sitting atop this jet ski looking for help, the current gently carried him out to sea, and he lost sight of land. And he thought, well, it's only going to be a matter of time before I see a helicopter, see a plane come overhead, or another jet ski comes and gets me. But no, it didn't happen all day, and he faced the night, a cold night. It just so happened the temperature of the water was not so cold that he would go through hypothermia. So he survived the night. He was very anxious. Do you know what his problem was now? His problem was water. Here he was in salt water, and he had no water. And as you read the story, he tells about how his lips swelled up. And, of course, he had been all Friday afternoon in this hot, scorching sun, and he was sun-blistered, you know, on his face and on his shoulders. But he was pretty ingenious, so what he decided to do was take off his bathing suit, which he did. He took off his bathing suit, and he put it over his head. It was a burgundy bathing suit. Put it over his head, and he just floated along. Finally, the machine under him became so waterlogged, even the cushions, that it gurgled away from him, but he was able to get a little bit of the cushion away from it that helped buoy him up while he was floating out there. And I'll tell you something. He's scared. You know what he's afraid of? Sharks. Yeah, somebody said sharks. That's exactly what he was afraid of. He was also worried about these other leviathans that he imagined in his mind that were going to come up from the deep and get him. And he tells a story about one that did come up onto him. He didn't say what it was, but it latched onto his leg, and he reached down there and he grabbed it. He didn't really know what it was, but he just hastily threw it away and just shuddered, just stood there and just shuddered. He knew he was in big, big trouble. Well, here he is into Saturday, and no one inside. And I could tell you all the other stories about what's going on with his wife and why the fellow didn't come back. That's another part of the story. Just let me say that there were problems with the government, and they couldn't get people out there. But here he is out bobbing in the water, and by now he's well out over 150 miles from where he started. He didn't realize that. He's thirsty. In all of this, lo and behold, it begins to rain. That's pretty important, because he has his little trunks on top of him, so he takes his trunks out while it's raining, and he squeezes all the moisture out of it, because that's salt water, and he puts it back up on his head, and he catches rainwater. Just as he's beginning to squeeze a few drops of the rainwater out of the trunks into his mouth, a big wave crashes over him and just douses him with salt water. And what I liked about what he said was the following. He didn't say, God, give me a break. He said, God, give me a break. And he just floated along. Because he realized then that he was not going to be tough enough to make it without a miracle. So here he is bobbing along out in the seas, out in the Gulf there. No one in sight, wondering what in the world is going to happen. Lo and behold, he goes into a little bit of delirium under the heat of the sun. And again, he's all blistered up. But he begins to think, and I thought this was interesting. I really don't know if there's anything to this. I'm just telling you the way the story was told in the book that I read. Here he is out there bobbing around in the water, and in delirium, he says, of all things, he says, why? Because he's what? He's thirsty. He says, my, I'd love to have a Coke, he says. Of all things, a Coke. And he just let it slide back. It would only be shortly thereafter that a plastic Coke bottle, it actually was not Coke, I think it was 7-Up, bobbed by, and he saw that. He looked at it, and it had all sorts of mollusks and crustaceans over it, because I guess it had come from a great distance. But he was desperate. And he grabbed that plastic bottle, looked at it, and in the bottom of it was a clear liquid. Now, I know what you're thinking, and I know what I'm thinking. I'm thinking, oh, my, how long did that thing have been afloat, and what's in there? He was desperate. So he pried that lid off of it, which was very tight, and he looked in there, and he smelled it, he said, and he thought it would be okay. He was desperate. It probably wouldn't have made any difference at all. So he took slowly two drinks, and that's all there was, of that liquid. And he says, I can make it. I'm going to go on. He didn't want to give up. It wasn't too long thereafter that he looked off on the horizon, and way off on the horizon was a little spot, a little dot, and he got his hopes up. Oh, he was all blistered up, and he was chafed underneath his arms because of that life jacket that he had, and he was almost motionless in the water. But you know, when you see a little speck way off in the distance, you can get pretty excited about it. And so he got excited, and he thought, could it be, could it be, could it be? And sure enough, it was a great big old huge tanker, 328 feet long, blue. And it got closer and closer and closer. As it got within sight of him, or where he could see it pretty clearly, he took his swimsuit off his head, and he waved it around, and as the waves would crest over, he'd come up and he'd yell and scream as best he could, but he was using all the energy that he had. And here was this great big, huge steel casing of a freighter. Way up there in the deck, he was looking for people, and he could see no one, not one person. But he decided to make the best of the situation because this was his one opportunity, he felt. And so he screamed, and he pounded the water with his hands like he was some kind of a, you know, rapid motion, seeing if that would help. Now, he got close, and I had something like this one time with Mr. Sharp or another member of the church. You can see these big bulbs up on the front of these ships. He even toyed with the idea of someone other trying to swim over there and grab a hold of it. But he thought better of that because he felt he'd be swept away in the current as the water was pushed away and probably get caught in the props. Now, I'll tell you something. This person had a problem. You know what he needed? He needed a miracle, didn't he? So he had said earlier on, he said, God, give me a break. Now, that's probably not the way I'd ask for it. Would you ask for it that way? Probably not. But does it make a whole lot of difference? Just as long as you get the hit. Just as long as you get the miracle. Well, just so happened that an engineer was on deck, up way up there on the ship, and he thought he heard something unusual. And he looked over the sides of the ship as he told the story, and he saw what he thought was the head of a man thrashing around with his arms, and his arms thrashing around. And he thought, no, that can't be. As he watched him being swept beyond the ship, then it dawned on him it was a man. And he said, man overboard! And they rallied behind him, and they put out a life ship, a lifeguard ship, and went down there and got him. When they dropped a little ladder to him, he was so exhausted, he couldn't even climb up the ladder. And six men had to carry him in. He was just totally, completely exhausted. What I found a little bit fascinating about all of this is when he finally got enough strength in his body to go up to where the captain is, he went up and was talking to the captain, and the captain asked him, he said, listen, he said, I want you to look out there at that great sea there, that vast, unlimited sea that we're going through, because now he was 200 miles away from where he started. And he says, I want you to tell me what the chances are that you could see a speck no bigger than the head of a man with the top of his body in the water. And he looked out there, and he realized it was probably no chance. And it dawned on him what an incredible event it was, in fact, that in a sea that is unmarked and with no intersections, that some or other they would track together. Let me tell you what what the dictionary says about a miracle. I thought, just for the sake of knowing, I wanted to see what man thought a miracle was. So I picked up Webster's, and this is what it says about a miracle. A miracle is an extraordinary event manifesting divine intervention in human affairs. I like that. Yes. It is also an extremely outstanding or unusual event, thing, or accomplishment. Well, I like that too. It is a divine natural phenomenon experienced humanly as the fulfillment of spiritual law. We could argue until we are blue in the face over definitions of a miracle, but I'll tell you what I believe. All of us in this room know whether or not you have experienced one. I don't care how we define it. You're going to know whether or not you've experienced it. We've all seen God answer our prayers in unmistakable ways. That encourages us to keep on praying. But because God doesn't always predictably answer our prayers, are we then to feel that we do not have faith or that we do not have the confidence to go on before God? No, let me tell you something, which I know you believe. You are to go on without an answer. And you are still called upon to pray, even in your darkest moments. Now, I don't mean just pray for yourself. I mean someone else who has the darkest moment. You are called upon to go on and pray for them, because people expect you and me to be people of faith, people of promise. That's right. Say, hang on. Hang in there. Don't you give up. God can do anything. You believe what you're saying. You believe it in your head, and you believe it in your heart. I would like to give just a few little guidelines here about going on with prayer when there are no answers. Just a couple little things here for you to think about. One of the very first things to do, it's a decision to make. It is to decide to be available and obedient to God. Now, what do I mean by that? I said to be available and to be obedient. When these people had called me into the intensive care unit, if I had not been available, I wouldn't have been able to go there and act as God's representative on their behalf, correct? But I didn't get the answer that I wanted. But I remember a lesson I was taught by a lady of faith one time. I'd like to share that with you. It was back in the hill country of North Carolina. You may find this incredible. I did. Because I didn't have the faith for it. I'll just tell you like it is. I didn't believe. Oh, I guess I believed a little bit. I better not say that, because I know that God can do anything. With God, nothing is impossible. I know that. But you know how you sort of build a case up for no answers? Let me tell you the case I build up. This lady came to me, and she was a lady of faith, as I mentioned to you. She was from the hill country. I'd been to her home and had dinner many times and visited, had wonderful hours with them. And she had two daughters. And she brought up her youngest daughter to me, and she said, "Listen here, I want to have my daughter anointed." I said, "Okay, what for?" And she showed me. This is probably embarrassing to her daughter. The little daughter said, the mother said to the little daughter, "Open your mouth." So she stood there and she pulled her lips back, and she had a tooth that was out of place, way up here in the gum. You know what I'm talking about? Way up there in the gum. What do you think I thought? Man of faith, minister of faith. What do you think I thought? I thought, there's no way. There's just no way. You know what I advised her to do? I advised her to go see the orthodontist. That's what I did. That was not bad advice. That was good advice. It really was. But she persisted with me, and she said, "Well, Mr. Groves," she said, I know. She says, "I can go to an orthodontist." But she says, "You know, I have a way of believing that God, I need to go to God first." And I said, "Well, fine, if that's what you want to do." And she said, "That's what I want to do." So we went back into a little room, much like this back here. And I took out that little bottle of oil that I showed you a while ago. And this lady wanted a miracle. I'll just tell you something. I was just available. I was just a tool. I was just someone to take oil and put my hands upon her head, because what did I think the solution was? To go to the orthodontist. That's where my faith was. It wasn't that God was going to make a difference. But I did prayerfully, according to James, according to the verses about healing. I laid my hands upon her and I anointed her. And I thought, well, I know where this is going to go. Next week, I learned a lesson. Next week, this lady came up with me, and she had the biggest smile on her face you've ever seen. She said, "Come here, I want to show you something." I felt sorry for her daughter again. Her little daughter's being yanked, opening her mouth all the time in front of me. She says, "I've got something I want to show you." And I thought, okay. So she said, "Look here." So Sarah, her daughter, opened up and said, "Look at what's happened." I couldn't believe it. Guess what? That tooth was in place. And I said, "What'd you do?" Great man of faith that I was. "What'd you do?" She said, "Well, we just prayed about it, and God, we had her anointed, and we put this in God's hand." And she said, "Sarah went to bed one night and woke up the next morning, and there you got it." Listen. That taught me a lesson. I still believe in going to the orthodontist. Don't misunderstand me. But all of a sudden, I understand something, that as a minister or as a person of faith, and if you're called upon, do the same. Would you be available? Be available. Maybe you don't believe it. Maybe you have reservations. But go there and pray with people, or pray about the situation. Be available. Don't dismiss it. You've got to be there. Be there and ask for the answers that the people want. You know something? God calls us to have compassion. God does not call me to be omnipotent. He truly doesn't. I'm not all-powerful, and I'm not all-knowing, and neither are you. To be compassionate is a great quality. It's something that plays a long way in God's sight and in the lives of God's people. God asks us to be available, to show compassion and to pray. It's okay to keep believing, even if we strike out 9 times out of 10. In fact, it's not only okay, it's essential that you keep praying, keep coming back to God. As I told you, without stepping up to the plate, without asking, you won't even get 1 out of 10. Now, another thing I want to encourage you to do here is to recognize in situations like this, when you're called upon for prayer, do so because you do have faith. Recognize that you do have faith. Most of the times when we are called upon to pray for people, do we have a lot of time to think about it? Now, I could single out and say, okay, let's all pray for this side of the room today. And we'll have time to think about it. But most times, we don't have a lot of time to think about it. We get an emergency phone call. Someone's in distress. Someone's been hurt. Some tragedy has fallen upon them. And they urgently and immediately ask for intervention. You don't have a lot of time to get ready. So you've got to have faith. Now, you will find yourself in prayer, I hope, even though you may feel a little bit unprepared. Don't let that keep you from praying. If you wait until you feel adequate, you will probably never accomplish anything substantial. I thought about that. The other day, it came to my heart and my mind again. I know Heather will identify with this a little bit because of a loved man in the church over in Florida who called into us. And as I told you in the Bible study a couple weeks ago, this gentleman, it was very painful for him because his son was dying, and his son was obviously younger than the father. And it's not supposed to work that way. And we sighed, and we prayed. And I remember I talked to Mr. Harry Love on the day that his son died. And I remember listening to him and how hard it was for him. And he had talked to us in Tyler because what did he want us to do? He wanted us to get a hit. He wanted us to be instrumental in a miracle. In this case, it didn't happen the way that he wanted to. But my, after I got off the phone talking with him the next day after his son had died, or 2 days thereafter, he was able to bolster me and encourage me. And I recognized that I was dealing with a man of faith who had lost his son. Another thing I want to encourage you to do is to have trust and not to be fatalistic. To have trust and not be fatalistic. What's fatalism? Fatalism is the doctrine that events are somehow or another fixed for all time in such a manner that human beings are powerless to change them. Well, if that's the case, then what good does prayer do? Que sera, sera. What will be, what will be. Pray a lot, pray a little. Don't pray. What difference does it make? Turn with me back to Psalm 34, if you will. 34th Psalm. These verses are very encouraging and enlightening. Because, you know, I don't know when the next time will come when I'm going to need that miracle. Nor do you know when that will be. Nor do we as a church know when we will need that miracle. So what do we do in the meantime? What will be, what will be, what difference does it make? No. Turn with me to Psalm 34. We'll read several verses here. Principally, I want you to notice down in verses 15 and 17, but let's work our way there. I will bless the Lord at all times. His praise shall continually be in my mouth. My soul shall make her boast in the Lord. The humble shall hear thereof and be glad. So, O magnify the Lord with me, and let us exalt his name together. I sought the Lord, and he heard me, and delivered me from all of my fears. They looked unto him, and were lightened, and their faces were not ashamed. It says in verse 6, the poor man cried, and the Lord heard him, and saved him out of all of his troubles. The angel of the Lord encamps round about them that fear him, and delivers them. You believe that? He surely does. O taste and see that the Lord is good. Blessed is the man that trusts in him. So have trust. Don't be fatalistic. O fear the Lord, you His saints, for there is no want to them that fear Him. It says in verse 10, the young lions do lack and suffer hunger, but they that seek the Lord shall not want any good thing. Come, ye children, hearken to me. I will teach you the fear of the Lord. What man is he that desires life and loves many days that he may see good? Keep your tongue from evil, he says, and your lips from speaking guile. Depart from evil and do good. You seek peace and you pursue it. Now the verses I wanted to draw attention to. The eyes of the Lord are upon the righteous, and his ears are open unto their cry. The face of the Eternal is against them that do evil, to cut off the remembrance of them from the earth. Verse 17. So the righteous cry, and the Lord hears, and delivers them out of all their troubles. It pays to keep on going up to that plate, doesn't it? The Eternal God hears the cries of His righteous people. It does say in verse 18, the Lord is nigh unto them that are of a broken heart, and saves such a one that is of a contrite spirit. And this verse probably many of you have memorized. Many are the afflictions of the righteous, but the Lord delivers him out of them all. Trusting God with the results, whatever they may be, increases my expectations without demanding that God fulfill them. Just trusting in Him. It helps me to recognize His work and to honor Him in whatever way He may choose to answer. Let me propose something to you. God may change the problem, or surprises upon surprises, He may even change me. And that would be a miracle. He may answer now, or He may answer later. Now let me give you the bottom line of all of this. The bottom line is, we are to be involved in prayer, even when we don't have all the answers. Turn with me to Lamentations, if you will. Lamentations, chapter 3. Jeremiah, Lamentations, chapter 3. Over in verse 22, here we have these encouraging words in this book of Lamentation. It is of the Lord's mercies that we are not consumed, because His compassions fail not. Do you ever feel that you're at the mercy of Almighty God, and the only reason why you make it is because He is so compassionate? So what if I did my best, I prayed my best, and unfortunately that little child was taken away from its mother and its father? That doesn't mean that God was not compassionate and not understanding. And I must accept His will and His way. Not only in that, but all sorts of other situations that we might come face to face with. He goes on to say this, they are new every morning. It's like you got to start over every single day, don't you? Start afresh, start new. God's mercies, God's compassion is new every single day. Great is thy faithfulness. The Lord is my portion, saith my soul. Therefore will I hope in Him. Verse 25, the Lord is good unto them that wait for Him. Even if you have to wait for 51 hours at sea, if I may use that analogy, without hope, 51 hours. The Lord is good unto them that wait on Him, to the soul that seeks Him. It is good that a man should both hope and quietly, so you hope and you quietly wait for the salvation of God. So guess what? I guess I'll just keep stepping up to that plate. And I guess I'll just keep looking at that pitch. And I'll keep trying to figure it out. I don't have it figured out exactly, but I want to tell you what I do have figured out. It's this. This is the bottom line. When we are called upon for miracles, whether praying for someone else, some incident, some occasion, some healing, when you are called upon for miracles, you and I, we trust God with the answers. Whatever they may be, content to know that He trusts us with the praying.